Good afternoon, FCB and ACB media people. Welcome to our annual town hall meeting. For those of you who don't know, and if you don't know, I can't, you just haven't been paying attention. I am Sheila Young, president of the Florida Council of the Blind. And we are very happy again in the flesh to be able to have our director of the Division of Blind Services, Robert Doyle, with us. He's not on Zoom, he's here. And a longtime friend and colleague of FCB. So, Mr. Doyle.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Robert Doyle, director at the Division of Blind Services. It is good to be here. It seems like we got a full crowd, and they're bringing extra chairs in the room to make room for others that are coming in. And when we came in initially, I was thinking, maybe folks aren't come to the convention. People are here. But it's good to see so many friends here today. And I'm going to give some updates. I'm going to leave some room for some questions.
And y'all tell me if it's too modern tone. If you want me to pick it up a little bit, if I'm going too fast, let me know. Other things going on with the division, I think many of you all may know that last year, it was last July, we had the federal government on site with us, and we went through a monitoring. Monitoring is like a federal program audit. They came into the state. They were with us for about 5 days. We had actually some participation from Paul Edwards and folks with our Rehab Council for the Blind. And RSA was on site. They pointed out a lot of stuff for us while they were on site. They went back and they wrote a report. They sent us that draft report at the end of December. And when they sent us a draft report, it had four findings in it. Four things. A finding is things that you're doing as an entity that is out of compliance. Thank you. That is out of compliance. We have four findings, and I'll talk about those findings if you all want me to go into those details. But it also had a lot of factual inaccuracies in it. It had a lot of challenges in the report itself. And we pointed those out to RSA. That's where we get our funds from for our federal programs. We pointed those out to RSA. They changed or softened their stance on some of those factual inaccuracies. However, their four findings, they allowed them to stand. We agreed with three of the four findings, and those findings relate to updating our policies, updating our internal controls. Internal controls are systems that you put in place to make sure that things work the way they're supposed to work, to make sure that whoever's in charge of doing this on a Tuesday does that on a Tuesday. That's just one example of an internal control. Some of those internal controls are happened through, they can be programmed into software. They kind of won't let you move to the next step until you do it. Other things, you've got to have calendars or other processes where there's checks and balances in place. But two of our major findings were centered around internal controls, both in terms of policies and procedures as well as in our fiscal procedures. Those were two of the findings. The other findings were in our fiscal area, where RSA wants us to go back and redo some reports. They want to make sure that we are spending the funds directly aligned to the to the year in which they gave us funds. Those are some things that we need to build in some strong internal controls into our software systems, but also make sure we've got the right controls in place. We're going to have to go back and do reports. We'll have to go back and do about 3 years worth of reports once we get those internal controls in place. And then the last area of findings is relating to both our contract area as well as with our vocational rehabilitation contracts for employment and our pre-employment transition services. So RSA doesn't like our contracts. They don't like those particular contracts. They think they're too complicated. They think there's too many penalties in them. They want us to go to a fee-for-service process relating to those contracts. And so in addition to the findings, they had lots of recommendations as well. We agree with some of the recommendations, but not all. And with this particular finding relating to our, we call it an inventory of competencies and functional abilities. It's a tool we use when students are going through our pre-employment transition process to identify what kind of services to give them. RSA says it's an assessment and you can't use pre-employment dollars for assessments. We disagree. We disagree, number one, that it's an assessment. We disagree that it's used as a tool to screen students in or out of our pre-employment transition services. RSA says because it's an assessment, they are requiring that we go back and count up the number of hours that we've utilized for pre-employment transition, for those inventories over the last few years, count them up, and then back those dollars out of our pre-ets expenditures and put them towards our general employment expenditures. This is an area that we strongly disagree with RSA on. I have drafted a letter to RSA, a nice Nancy Graham, so to speak, expressing our disagreement relating to this particular finding. Certainly, we want to come into compliance in those areas that we agree, but asking them to reassess that. We let them know that when we made that tool available for the Pre-Employment Transition Services Program, we took the advice, we took the edits, we took the information from their very own Technical Assistance Center. They had funded a Technical Assistance Center, and through that Technical Assistance Center, we took and developed that tool. And so we're saying it's your center that gave us this direction. And as a result of that, we do not agree with your position on this. And we're asking them to change it. And we told them that we will be willing to appeal that decision if we need to. And so that's one of our engagements with RSA right now. We have sent that off to them. It's our initial corrective action plan that will be available online for folks to view, both the monitoring report as well as the response and the finding. I'm going to stop right here because I see Mikey's got his hand up, and I'm going to take a sip of water while he asks a question or makes a comment.
You sure you want to do this, Director?
Yeah, I'm good.
Would you be kind enough to peel back some of the layers in those deliverables that RSA is saying should not fall under pre-ets so that the public understands what services were being delivered, that in essence, if this moves forward, will no longer be available to pre-employment transition students if we don't push back against this.
Right. So thank you, Mikey. So when pre-employment transition services, is the mic close enough? Okay. So when RSA and actually the legislature required states to carve out 15% of our funds for students for pre-employment transition services, they said you can only provide services in five categories. These are called core services. It's instruction and advocacy, work-based learning experiences. It's like introduction to colleges, and there are five core services. And I'm not able to recall the five set directly, but they required that in that process you could not do an assessment. What they didn't want states to do is they didn't want states to basically screen students away from the program. One of the things about pre-employment transition services is that you don't actually have to apply for services to get them. You don't have to not have an IPE, an individual plan for employment. You just have to be somebody who is potentially eligible for services. Now, that works very well for a general VR agency because you've got folks who have lots of potentialities for being eligible for services, meaning that you may be on a 504 plan or you may be getting special education services or you're thought to have a disability. But for a blind agency, right, we want to make sure we're serving individuals who have a visual impairment. We don't want the limited resources that we have going to, I'll give an example. I had a lighthouse at one point that was sending somebody over with pink eye. And so for our potentially eligible services, we want to make sure there's a reasonable likelihood that the individual actually would qualify for services. And so one of the things that we do as an agency that kind of mitigates one of those challenges you asked about, Mikey, is that anybody who typically will come to us for pre-employment transition services, we typically will say, even though you don't need to have a plan of services, an IPE, I would say 99% of our students have an IPE. Because what that does is that immediately makes all the services of vocational rehabilitation available to those clients. Otherwise, they only have access to those five core services, and they only have access to services that you might need to access those five core services. Let's say, for example, I can't give you orientation and mobility in general if you don't have a plan, if you're getting pre-eds. But if you need orientation and mobility in order to access a work-based learning program, then I can give it to you under pre-eds. And so what RSA is doing, in our opinion, when they say, okay, well, you can't do this assessment, this inventory of competence and functional abilities, you can't charge this to pre-eds, but you can charge it to VR, they're basically saying that you can't spend the dollars on that. And I use a term in my letter. I says that instead of allowing us to provide services, they're really having us chase regulatory minutia. And that's really what it comes down to. So we've got to spend a lot of time and hours going back and trying to recalculate how many hours were spent doing this inventory that RSA's team told us this is how you do it, so that we can recharge them to the general VR grant, as opposed to spending the time working on some of those other compliance areas. So I guess in the nutshell, Mikey, it doesn't necessarily take away from the services that we're able to provide, because those students are getting services under individualized plan of employment. Because we get them to an IPE, even though most don't do that for pre-eds. But what it does is it wastes time trying to, fit something in a different area that doesn't necessarily need to, which means it takes time away from staff, it takes time away from IT, it takes away time that folks can be using actually serving clients along the way.
I'm assuming that they pegged the vocational evaluations in this as well.
They would say that a vocational evaluation cannot be used for pre-employment transition services.
So, as Mikey, Florida Council of Blind Individual, you never mind the fact that, for full disclosure, that's what we do, right? That's my job. That's a challenge, right? Because part of the investment that the DSO made on the survey and the blind services made, in a big collaboration that we're all very proud of here in Florida, was that survey, which helps identify needs. I mean, as it is, and this pre-ed bundle that's available for individuals to choose from, the combination of the vocational evaluation and the survey really does provide a great snapshot for counselors. We feel, the folks that were in the trenches putting this all together, in order to calibrate and make the options on the shelf available in a manner in which they can absorb it and most benefit. And I personally, am concerned that we are going to just roll over pre-eds in its entirety, and then, if we're just doing IPEs, those numbers are not going to look good in the long run, because if we're dealing with youth in transition, right, pre-employment training services, it's expected it's going to take a minute, right? So if we're writing a plan for employment, I don't see a 26 in an immediate future, because we're going to have to put them on a longer educational pathway, a longer training pathway. I hear you, but just so you know, I'm not happy.
Understood. And let me say this again, Mikey. I think for us, most states, the way they do pre-employment transition services, and particularly general agencies, but most folks, what they do is they see, and RSA has described pre-employment transition services as that earliest set of services available. And then maybe, I've seen some states, they may provide these services without a plan for the first year or two of a student while they're in high school. But my challenge with that for an individual who's blind is that means that, or anybody in general, honestly, is that means that they're not able to access all the other services that are available through the full VR program or through the transition program. And that's why we, in terms of Florida Blind Services, made it a point to create our process that it brings that student to an IPE in the beginning. Now, one of the things that we did do this year is a little bit different when we did our vocational rehabilitation and transition contracts. We changed them last October in anticipation of this monitoring findings that were coming out, because RSA made some comments. But one of the things that we did do is, and RSA pointed out to us, there are some services that you can provide to a client before they ever get an IPE, right? And so some services, we said, like pre-employment transition services, is we said, listen, that's pre-ETS, the core five, you can provide them before the client gets an IPE, but keep moving towards an IPE. because we believe that we want to have, we know that we want to have that full subset of services available that are available through the general program. So I think we've mitigated RSA's position on that by getting most folks. We have a small group, and I think the most I heard at one point, maybe 40 students who were not on an IPE, who were receiving pre-eds. And sometimes that's because of, you know, trying to gather information, whether it's social security numbers or those kind of things, because with pre-eds, you don't even have to have a social security number. Or that person just really didn't want to go for the full program. But if they don't go for the full pre-employment transition program, then they don't have access to all the services that are available through the division.
My question is, because of our trip to Tallahassee in February, because of the concerns about DBS going under APD, where does that stand?
So what we know, and again, I'm I work for the state, and so I don't have any positions contrary to any that may be taken by the state from my personal position, or from my position as the agency director. We do know that there had been some discussions about the division and Voc Rehab being moved over to APD. I understand that APD is the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. They primarily work with folks who have developmental disabilities, but the name of the agency is kind of a misnomer. People hear Agency of Persons with Disability, and it gives you this mindset that every agency with a person with disability, every agency should be under this umbrella. And so last year there was a bill was drafted. When it arrived at the legislature, I was told that the bill was pretty much DOA, dead on arrival. I do know that some consumer groups reached out, and some have actually reached out to some legislators and said, hey, we hear this is going on, we don't like it. And we encourage folks, you know, if you hear these things are going on, you reach out and say you don't like it, you let them know that's what your position is relating to those things. I'm not sure if that's what caused it to go DOA last year. I do think there's a likelihood, a potential that a bill like that could get presented again for the session that will start in January. And so what we do is we encourage folks to keep track of the legislation that's happening in Tallahassee. If you see legislation that you support or legislation that you're against, to reach out to your legislators. And that's one of the things I know that folks like Mikey, and I actually Adrian was talking about, she was just in D.C. as well, you know, that you maintain relationships, not just when you need the legislators, that you maintain those relationships. I did hear somebody tell me last year when they heard this, they said, I'm calling my senator. I'm calling Senator Baxley. I had a couple of folks that they were going to call Senator Baxley. Senator Baxley has been somebody who has been a staunch proponent for services for the blind. And somebody quoted Senator Baxley, says, hey, that's not good for blind people, you know, if that were to occur or to happen. So what I would say to folks is to, again, stay engaged, watch the process. Anticipate that a bill could come up again in this coming legislature, and try to preempt it, or try to communicate prior to where you are, whether you're for or against, what those talking points are, and to have them ready. My understanding is that the draft legislation was going to combine both agencies and move them over, but again, it was dead on arrival. My understanding is also that, you know, we've had a number of good years fiscally. You know, state has done very well in terms of surpluses and things like that over the last few years, but we know that surplus don't last always. And I've heard some predictions that in the coming legislative session there may be less provisions, less made available. And so, you know, as times get tighter, sometimes people believe that, hey, if we lump these agencies into a single entity or into a single division, that's going to save money. But as we look around the nation where we see where that has occurred, even folks who've taken a blind agency and moved them and just made them part of a general agency, one, we know blind people don't get services as well. They don't get as many outcomes in terms, and people who have the most severe blindness, totally blind, don't get the level of services that they need in a general agency. But some of those general agencies, when they thought they were going to save money, ended up having to backtrack. Now, they didn't go as far as creating a new agency for the blind, but what they ended up doing is moving to a combined agency where blind services were housed in a bureau alongside of general VR services under one division or under one department. And so, again, it has not been proven, and maybe proven the opposite way, that combining a blind agency with a general agency is going to save money. And so, again, I think that's one of the talking points that folks use. And I know I've used it in the past where folks have talked about combining us, not necessarily just moving us over to a different department. This idea of APD has come up a number of times over the last, 12, 13 years. It's come up a number of times. I think it probably got its closest last year, possibly. But again, I would just tell folks to keep watching. While we're waiting on questions, speaking of the legislature this last year, and I give round numbers, the division actually saw about almost a 20% increase in our base budget. It was a good year for us, good year for our consumers and our programs. But it did end with some disappointment. one of the reasons why we were monitored by RSA is because we had given back $8 million 1 year, $6 million another year. And when I say given back, it doesn't mean that we had dollars that we had been spending before that we no longer were able to spend. What it means is that the federal government had made available to us more dollars, but we didn't have the authority from the legislature to spend all those dollars. And so that's one of the challenges that we were dealing with. And so we had gone through the process. The governor included in his budget. The legislature had it in their budget. We were trying to get about $7 million additional dollars where we could draw down the full amount, be able to spend the full amount of dollars that the federal government made available to us. And that included about another $2 million in state dollars that we would use to match to bring those dollars down. And it was in the budget all the way up until the last 3 days of session, and then it went away. And so that created a setback for us. It puts us in a position that without having that authority, we're not going to be able to spend all the money the federal government makes available to us and get that out to whether it's our providers or to consumers to make those needs. And I can tell you, I don't know if I see a hand up in the back. I might see a hand up in the back. I can tell you that that we have been stretched this year in our resources. I've got Dan O'Connor here, who's our district administrator here in Tampa. I mean, here in Jacksonville. He's our district administrator, and I know he's been asking for it. They need more money for more things, and they at one point got a $50,000 additional allocation, and I think got another $50,000, and it's just not enough. Our districts are needing dollars. Yep. We know the cost of things are going up. And we did not get that extra $7 million this year. Although we had a good year, and if I have time, I'll talk about those things that we did get in the budget. That was a setback for us, and we're going to have to find a way to work around that in this coming year. Yes, sir.
We have a problem when we get information, we don't get all the information.
All right.
And then we get misinformation because we'll go and say, we just heard that X amount of dollars is available, and we'd like to do something with that, and they say, we don't have the money. You know, that's at our level. That's not at the top. We go through that daily. I would like to do this or do that. No, there's no money available, but we don't have the money. But when I go and go higher, they say the money's there. People have gotten to the point where they don't want to do the paperwork or go through the challenges to get something done. And we need to have a way that we can eliminate that so that when we know the information, all we got to do is go ahead and move on it.
All right. So this is at your district office where you're here and we don't have the money. All right. So what happens is that every year our budget officer and the folks who lead the client service division, they put a budget out for each district. And that district has a set budget that they work with. If that district runs out of money, they can request additional dollars, and that happens. And so as long as those additional dollars are available, because we do keep a reserve back in the state office for that purpose. We are balancing things, as I mentioned, because we haven't had all of the authority. But I will tell you again, if there's something that you need at the local district office, and I'm saying this to everybody, if there's something that you need as part of your plan, you need it, and the district is telling you we don't have the funds, ask them if they have put a request into the state office for those additional funds, because sometimes we can move dollars around to make those funds available to the local district offices.
But it would seem like those funds were available if you say you had to give back $8 million.
Right, so that's the clarification. So the clarification is I'm gonna try to make this simple. The clarification is this. Let's say, for example, we have been spending, and this is just an example. We've been spending about $30 million for our employment programs every year. The feds have been making more available to us each year. So next year it might be $31 million, and next year it might be $32 million, and it gets up to $38 million. We still have been spending the $30 million. What we haven't been able to do is to tap in that extra $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. So when I say giving money back, it's not money that we've been spending. We're still spending the $30 million. We're just not able to spend the extra money that the feds have made available. And so when I say giving money back, that's what I mean by giving money back. Yes.
Mr. Doyle, thank you so much for coming to us today. And my concern is in relationship to, and I guess this is a dollars and cents type of thing too, where you have one person who is brilliant in what he does as far as technology and a whiz with computers, but he's only one person. And for one person to handle seemingly the whole state of Florida, I'm wondering if there is a chance that monies can be provided where someone will be hired to help this person to be added to staff or whatever, to be able to cover the state of Florida whenever a need arises for tech support. And thank you for taking my question.
No, thank you for the comment and the question. Now, I don't know if you can give me a little bit more specifics. Are we talking about, like for example, Adam Gaffney in Tallahassee, or are we talking about maybe somebody at the residential center or somebody at a lighthouse? At a lighthouse. Okay. All right. So given the example of the lighthouse, the division provides funds to the lighthouse. We expect the lighthouse to take the funds that we give them and to have the staff on board that are necessary to meet the needs of the clients that are there. That's our expectation. And what we're finding, though, this is a challenge. We're finding that there are fewer folks available who are qualified to provide services, whether it's a certified vision rehab therapist, or whether it's a teacher for the visually impaired, or whether it's somebody who has AT abilities. And so we are finding this as a challenge, and even where sometimes they have the money, we're having trouble finding people to do it. And we've got to figure out how to solve this challenge. I was in a meeting earlier this week in Tallahassee talking about this, trying to figure out, do we fund the universities? One of the problems is that some of the colleges and universities they're not getting enough students in order to justify the expenditure of having a professor and things on board. And so we're trying to find out, do we allow for certificates? Do we allow for apprenticeships? Do we allow for, some interim level to get a person to the level that they need to be? But all in all, I will say that your lighthouse has a requirement in their contract, to the extent that there are folks available, and I'm going to say this as well, to provide those services. They've got to reach out to us before they can put somebody on the wait list. And if they don't have somebody on staff, then they need to find somebody to contract with to provide those services. I will say, in terms of the division itself, we've gone through a great process of doing wage increases. Again, I want to thank this council for your advocacy for so many years, saying, hey, you got to pay DBS staff more. And we've been going through a series of wage increases for our team. We're really excited about that. As part of that process, we've gone through and we've looked at vacancies in the area, and we said, okay, this position's been vacant for so many long, or how long, how can we reuse this position somewhere else in the agency? And so we've identified a number of positions that we're looking to reallocate, redistribute across the agency. We've done the same thing with the lighthouses. Like, for example, we're just doing the older blind contract. And during the older blind contract and our distributions, we've had some lighthouses who have not reached the number of clients they're supposed to reach. And this year, if we reallocate it, each year we may take a few back, but this year some lighthouses, we took, 25, 30 clients out of their contract, and we gave those clients to a different contract, to a different lighthouse, for them to provide services. Because if that CRP is holding on to the dollars and they're not able to meet the client's needs, then we can meet those clients' needs somewhere else in the state, or if they're not reaching that many of clients. So I think one of our biggest winners this year in terms of lighthouses is the I think it's over in the Villages. I believe it's New Vision. They ended up going from 75 people contracted to serve for older blind up to 130. So they got the biggest increase on their contract because they have been showing that they've been serving folks. I see a couple of hands. I'm not sure if Paul got a microphone back there or.
Good afternoon, Mr. Doyle, and thank you for coming. And in my district, the problem we have is that I want to know the reason why they don't answer the phone. And we know that if they're not there, the secretary will tell you, well, they're not in today. So once they transfer you to them, we know they are there, but they don't answer the phone and they don't call you back. So I would like to know why is that going on for so long, Something needs to be done about that, because you cannot get the service if they don't answer the phone.
Now, are we talking at DBS, or are we talking about the lighthouse?
No, DBS.
DBS, okay.
In Miami.
Okay. That's a challenge. That's a challenge. I know that, I give a lot of kudos to Pamela Ortiz and her team in Miami, because they are doing great things down there. But somebody's got to answer the phone. I do know that we recently have shifted our phone system from hardwired phones to something they call Microsoft Teams phones. And so I have heard from some of the folks in the field that there's been a transition challenge, that sometimes how you're working on your computer and then you turn away from the computer and then your screen locks and then somebody's calling and you can't get to the phone. I think that could be some of the challenges. I'd like to think that could be some of the challenges. I've got at least one employee shaking their head yes in the room. And so trying to figure out how to fix that challenge with the soft phones. But that is something that I've heard. I think folks are also going through a learning curve there. But people need to be able to answer the phone, because you need to know that we're there to serve. And so what I will do is I will follow up with the Miami office and kind of see where they are with that. And I will encourage you that if, let's say, for example, if you're reaching out to your local office and you're not hearing back from them in 48 hours or so, send an email. And if you need to, reach out to the state office as well. Silent Miller in the state office, send us an email. We will reach out. We will put you in connection with them. I hope you don't have to go that route. But at the same time, I don't want you to feel like I don't want you to be not able to be heard or have your calls answered. And I'm hoping, we just got our soft phones this last week. So I'm hoping that you don't find that problem with us answering the phones because the software has done that. Now, I can tell you myself, now I'm not sure that every one of our employees would want to do this. I have my Microsoft Teams on my cell phone. So if I need to dial from there or answer from there, I can do that. So that is an option for folks as well. My wife, when we first got married, what are you going to say, Tisha? She said she's used to it. She told me a long time ago when we first got married, again, 27 years, because I used to answer the phone. I was on student government and all of those things back then. And she told me, this phone is here for your convenience. You answer it when you need to answer it, but not when you don't. So, all right. I'm not embarrassing you. All right. I see a hand in the back.
Okay. Hi, Mr. Doyle. It's Mary Tyson. I'm currently a library employee. I'm very disappointed Nicole couldn't be here, but she has been sick. So, but you brought up something of which I was very interested. Do you have any idea? I know you're not the tech guy. I know you're not the engineer. But do you have any idea when the library will be having this phone system that I've been hearing about since I came to work there in July?
Yes. I actually saw an email this week. And it's coming. Let me see if I can. I'll see if I can pull that email up while we're talking, and see if I can give you a date for that. So you're anxiously anticipating it, huh?
Yeah. Okay. we'll go with that.
I'm
I'm a little concerned about being actually physically tethered to my computer. So.
I do understand. One thing I will say, and again, it's not something that I'm trying to overly promote, because obviously the department and the team are trying to work really hard to get everybody on the system. But hard phones are available as an accommodation where needed. And so just keep that in mind.
I'm happy to do whatever. I'm interested to learn about it. I'm not fighting it. I'm just curious about it. And I know we've been talking about it for a while, and I was just wondering when. And just one more thing, little OT, but if anybody, I love working at the library. I've been there for almost a year now, and if anybody has any questions or problems, please call us. We really do love to talk to y'all. It is the most fun job I've done in a long time.
Well, we're glad you're here. We are. I'm actually looking at an email, and again, this could have changed. This was April 25th. I saw another email earlier this week, and I'm just trying to scroll through these quickly. They were looking to switch in Daytona. This goes back to a money thing. They needed some money in order to do it. It wasn't a whole lot of money, but the budget guy Mitchell says we should wait until July 1 to make that purchase. So I'm not sure if that's going to put that whole project in Daytona off until July 1. I'm not sure if it's going to put it all off to July 1, but that's one thing I'm seeing as I quickly scroll through these emails. You're welcome. And again, as I talk about money again, sometimes I know that I know we're really, really tight on what's available. We have dollars sometimes in different categories. So, for example, I've got tons of money available in our budget category, in our salary category because of vacancies. But I can't exactly move that over for Microsoft Teams phones, or can't exactly move that over for client services. But we do try to leave a reserve available for client services, as I mentioned earlier, to move it over to be able to meet it out to the districts as they need them. And then we find ways when we need to find ways to do things. All right, I will do some more talking while folks may be thinking, if you want to raise your hand. I mentioned other things in this legislative session. During this legislative session, we did get some new dollars. We got some new dollars to increase our rates being paid to our contractors, our lighthouses. And so some of our lighthouses are getting big increases. For example, the division paid about $3,000 for every blind baby from birth to five. That amount is going up to close to $6,000 for every blind baby. We were paying $2,100 for the adult program. The adult program of individuals 18 to 54 who are not planning to go to work or not vocational. And that went from the $2,100 to $700. Now, there's a caveat with that adult program. And the caveat with the adult program is we are trying to shrink that program. And the reason we're trying to shrink that program is because RSA has said more people can go to work, try to get more people to work. And even people who you think have severe multiple disabilities, try to help them get to work. And so that's one area. Secondly to that is Florida is an employment first state. That means we should consider employment first. And so having less folks in independent living services and more folks going vocational, we have revised that, I see a hand. We have revised that contract to allow for pre-vocational services under the independent living program. And then finally, I'll say this relating to older blind. The older blind program has gone from $2,100 to $2,500. Not as much because there's a bigger population of people to be served. We are serving more people. We've increased the amount available for people on that contract as well. I mean, the number of people to be served under the contract as well, and increase the dollar amount. We've also increased, and I see your hand, Mikey, we've also increased the adaptive aids. So under the older blind program, it used to be $100 that the CRP could provide. We've raised that to $250 that the CRP could provide in adaptive aids. We've added an adaptive AIDS component to the blind babies contract for $500. If that baby needs up to $500 in adaptive AIDS, that CRP has the funds to provide them. And then finally, for the adult program, we've increased that amount to $500 as well in adaptive AIDS from $100. And so the CRPs have that money in the budget, assuming the budget gets signed once it's presented to the governor. Mikey.
So I have a question and then a agitating question.
All right.
And I'm gonna roll around in my sweet spot here that I have no muzzle on and no leash because I can, you know, I'm an individual citizen right now. The first question is in reference to the significant, and I applaud the uptake in the fees in what's being paid out for the services that are rendered primarily through the lighthouses and stuff like that. Are you guys expecting more now that you're paying more? So for example, and I'm not pointing any specific entity out, right? But we know, being the Florida Council of the Blind, that, you know, any one of anybody that's been through services may not be getting, or they may feel that they're not getting a continuous flow of information and able to put down good foundational blocks in order to build on some of the training that is available because of the scheduling in places that offer these services. So I feel that with, you know, with a couple $1,000 increase, that one could say, well, you know, we want more. So is that a conversation that's happening?
It is. That's a great question. And we're trying to balance it out. And so this is what I say with that. We've told the CRPs, we've talked about increasing frequency of services. We didn't exactly put that new language in there. So, for example, we were playing around with doubling the frequency. One of the things that the CRPs pointed out to us during that process is say, hey, you know, when we told you this is how much it costs us to provide this service, we told you this is how much it costs us to provide this service based on the current contract. And so for us, it was trying to be both both get more from the CRP, and at the same time acknowledge the fact that this is what their reported costs were under the old model. And so what we've done is we've shortened some time frames. We've put some language in there. We've eliminated some thresholds. And what I mean by this is that, you know, back in the day we had contracts, and RSA raised this issue, where we had contracts that unless you fail to less than 80% of what the contract calls for, let's say you're supposed to give 100 hours, unless you fail to 80 hours, we weren't going to issue a financial consequence. Well, what we're doing now is we're saying, you've got to give us 100% of those hours for 100% of these dollars. And so that's one of the ways that we're requiring more out of the CRPs. Give us 100%, and if you don't, then we're going to take those dollars back from you. And so that's one of the ways. And then we've put in the contract that they cannot implement a wait list unless they consult with us. We've told them that they've got just a little bit of time to let us know whether they can serve a client. And if they cannot serve a client within that time, we've told them very specifically in the contract that we have a right to send this client to somebody else. So whether it's you can't serve them in the number of days, or whether it's because of whatever it might be, that we have a right to move. We've always had that right, but we are emphasizing that right to them because we're hearing from folks that, you know, hey, I've got a wait list, or these things that are going on in the field. Mikey.
Now comes the part that you're going to cringe. Okay. So we get it that everybody has to answer to a higher authority. And in the world that we live in, our higher authority is RSA. And oftentimes, you know, based on what you're telling us, based on what you've shared, based on our life experience and what we know to be true, are you willing to tell us a little bit about who is at RSA right now, and when was the last time that they did any of the frontline jobs? Because when we you know, from an advocacy standpoint, you know, a lot of us just came back from Tallahassee, from DC. We sit there and we plead for money for older blind, right? Mm-hmm. We know that the number one reason for keeping people out of assisted living facilities is the ability to self-medicate, right? That's the lowest hanging fruit on the tree. And we know that if they end up in assisted living or if they're unable to remain independent, the cost is exorbitant. Yet the pittance, I mean, you're very proud of a $100 increase for adaptive, what was the word you used?
Adaptive aids.
Adaptive aids.
$150 for older blind.
Yeah.
$400 for adult program.
Right.
$500 for blind babies. That's the increase. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
and we applaud every step is something, but I mean, a $200, $300 piece of equipment, sometimes it's just not going to cut it to keep somebody completely independent, especially when it comes to our older blind.
Right.
So we're cutting one corner here to then spend a lot later on. And oftentimes, while I do believe that the folks that make the decisions at RSA have the best of intentions, I'm just wondering just how out of touch they really are with everyday life, from a commoner, from a layman's perspective, as to the how difficult it is to give up benefits, needs-based benefits, right? Mm-hmm. To enter the workforce, adjustment to blindness. There's a lot of things there, but it seems like when these decisions come down, I know they sound great at the table when they come up with them, but I mean, we're here. We're all living proof of how some of these movements, some of these decisions, are just keeping our struggle alive. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
So Mikey, I don't mind answering that question. I will say first that RSA has a new commissioner. His name is Dante Allen. He is an individual with a disability and has been, I believe, all his life. And I've had a chance to talk with him, connect with him. I like him. He's a cool dude. He is relatable. He understands. He's been doing a number of listening tours. However, he has a staff who is very bureaucratic. He has a staff that we are very frustrated with. And we had a listening session with him, and some may call it a gripe session, when we met with him, and he had some of the staff in the room. And I actually went to Carol Doback, who has been the acting commissioner a few times, who's blind, by the way. And she has been very bureaucratic for many years and very frustrating for many years. And I said, I hope I didn't get myself in trouble or something. She says, Robert, I didn't hear you say anything I haven't heard you say before. And so, yeah, we're frustrated with them. We like I told them in that letter, regulatory minutiae. It feels like a lot of times at RSA, and again, I'm sure this is not the case, but they look for reasons to make our jobs harder. I'm sure that's not what the case is, but that's what it feels like oftentimes. And we were just on a call a little bit earlier this week, and I'm trying to remember what the call. It was relating to RSA had wrote a state and told the state that they could not use their VR dollars to back up a blind operator in the business enterprise program if there was an arbitration. They can't use the money for attorney fees to pay their attorney general to help support that blind operator in arbitration. And the agency in question is like, I ain't got no other money. This is a program funded by RSA. Why would you do? And I told Carol at the time, I said, please stop making it harder for us to do our jobs. It's like the monitoring, when they come out and do the monitoring. And I told the new commissioner, we're okay with accountability. We're okay with holding us accountable for. We keep our contractors accountable. We keep our staffs accountable. But what we don't need is all of this regulatory challenges making it difficult for us to do our jobs as directors. We had somebody that did a study. Thank you. I'm going to clap with you. Right? We had somebody do a study in the last 10 years. That's been over 200 changes to directorships in VR agencies. Over 200 changes, and part of it is because of the regulatory minutiae of RSA.
Hello, Mr. Doyle?
Yes.
This is your Zoom host, and you have a raised hand in Zoom if you would like to take it.
All right. And then Paul Edwards afterwards. Yes.
Sorry. Okay. Elizabeth, you may unmute.
Okay, I couldn't sound the unmute. This is Elizabeth Bowden. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, how are you doing, Mr. Robert?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, I've been better. And I have three. This is a long one. Items. The first item is that I see a lot of, especially the placement specialists, which the ones I've always worked with have not been, the best. And of course, you have to be really good to sell blind people and also know about them a lot before you start doing it. You can't assign them inaccessible job applications or inaccessible work places that their work product doesn't meet ADA standards. The other item is that before you can hire people, the web products have to be ADA compliant. And in the state of Florida, that's probably 30 compliant to 60 not. From what I've, learned trying to be employed in Florida, okay? So the second thing is there any thought about trying to get the CRPs to instruct their consumers to advocate for themselves? There never is any regulation about trying to get their employees or their constituents to learn about the consumer groups. And that's where the disconnect in, lesser and lesser youth and young adults are getting involved with the consumer groups. So eventually that'll lead to, no more people advocating for, agencies like yours to get funded.
Right.
So, and I always was bothered by that because in the CRPs where people are, primarily coming from the place where it's new vision loss, unless they have some really good role models for workers, which ours, the one that we have only has right now two, and of blind people that work there, those people don't understand how independent and self-sufficient blind people can be. And the staff don't even know because they're not exposed to people that are on the other side.
Exactly. Thank you, Elizabeth. Sorry to interrupt you here. I know that I've got a couple minutes. I want to try to answer that question for you very quickly. And then I know Paul Edwards, I think, is going to get the last question before.
Okay. Excellent.
So, number one is that the CRPs are supposed to be providing training and advocacy. That's part of the expectation. It's part of the contract. It doesn't say specifically, you've got to send somebody to, the FCB or NFB or anything to that nature, but it is a part of the list of services they're supposed to be providing. And I have heard from a number of you about CRPs today. I heard about some of the CRP challenges even when I visited district office on yesterday. I am pleased to let you all know that we are working on a new survey, and again, another survey. We're working on another survey of active clients. Right now we do a survey with closed clients, but active clients with the CRPs, so we can kind of get some real-time data about what's happening with those CRPs, are they serving you when you should be served, and those kind of things. And we're going to be able to use that data to drive more decisions and to drive more contract changes. Paul Edwards, who I'm going to turn the line over to for the next question, has been working with us on a subcommittee for that. And so, Paul, with that being said, I'm going to let you take the last question or comment. Oh,
So I wanted to raise, to make one comment and then raise a question for you to comment on. The comment that I wanted to make is one of the projects that was started as a result of recommendations from this council, and particularly from Carl McCoy, is a project called the Senior Equipment and Training Program. And that program has been operating now for the last 14 months, and we've probably put about $150,000 worth of equipment into the hands of seniors who don't otherwise qualify for equipment. And we're in the process of developing some training that we think is going to be exciting. What we're going to try to do is do something that on the surface of it seems very simple. But we are going to ask the library to put some tutorials onto cartridges and then distribute those cartridges to individuals who are blind or visually impaired and seniors who need some supplementary help with the training they've already received from CRPs. So we think this will be a really good way of providing at least some of the training that seniors actually need. And then if those cartridges don't work, we can look at seeing whether we can get them back into CRPs for additional training. But we certainly think that's the right answer. But the question I had for you was to ask you to talk a little bit about something that we're required to do in the state every 3 years that I think our folks probably need to know something about, and that's the comprehensive needs assessment. We've just completed one, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what those are for and perhaps something about what this one demonstrated.
Paul, thank you. I don't know if I'll have time to get to all of those, and I have to try to pull up my notes from the report. But every 3 years, the feds require us to do a comprehensive statewide needs assessment, and they want us to look at the needs of consumers, of unserved consumers, of underserved consumers, whether it's rural areas or different minority groups. They want us to look at the needs of youth. And we go through a pretty extensive process. We contract, it's been with universities in the past, and with those contracts, we've had them meet with consumer groups, with the CRPs, with our DBS staff and others, and through that process, identify things that we need to be doing more of as a state in order to better serve our consumers. Part of that might be meeting more CRPs in some areas. I know some of the findings were, you know, staff either vacancies or staff or client waiting lists. They identified challenges with staff. I mean, with vacancies and oh boy, I lost it that quick. What I can do though, Paul, I'll send it out to Sheila. Maybe you can send it out to the council, that triennial needs assessment and the summary as well, that list out what those major things were that as an agency, they're not inconsistent with some of the things that have been identified in the past, whether it's rural areas, being able to provide virtual instruction, or like you said, with the CRPs, where there may be a challenge with meeting needs, but also do we need to establish more CRPs or make services available through other mechanisms than what we have right now. I'll also say this in relation to the Senior Equipment and Training Program. Great program. Thank you, Paul, for your leadership and the leadership of the Blind Services Foundation. The division is looking to have additional funds made available for equipment as well, and talking about how that works in conjunction with the Senior Equipment Training Program. We'll be talking to the Blind Services Foundation about that as well. One more question. She said quickly.
When I first became blind, I didn't know anything about anything. And there was no place that you could go to find out information. It's like this organization operates in the darkness. And we're trying to get people out of the darkness, but the organization has to become visible. It's a lot of people that don't know that this is happening until my doctor felt like he said, I'm going to send you to the lighthouse and see what they can do for you. I don't know exactly what they're going to do, but they gave me the opportunity to go to work, but they gave me the opportunity to know that there were other things that are available that I didn't even think about. And if people aren't made aware that there's an availability, they're just going to wander around in the darkness.
Right.
We have to find a way to become visible.
I thank you for that. I know that we've put some funds into outreach over the last couple of years. We want to try to do more of that. It might be something that we work with the Blind Services Foundation on as well, because there's certain dollars we can use for employment but not otherwise. And then how can we more concentratedly or put a bigger concentration on those doctor's offices and getting outreach to those doctor's offices. The last thing I'm going to say is we are in the process of working on our legislative request for next year. We are drafting things right now. What are we going to ask in terms of policies? What are we going to ask in terms of funds? This council, I've got to say, and I've got some good friends over with NFB, and I know we've got some folks here who know folks with NFB as well, but I got to say that this council, the Florida Council of the Blind, has over the last number of years put forth the most initiatives that we've been able to actually see implemented. And so I want to thank you all for that and encourage you to continue to send forth those thoughts and ideas.
Thank you, Director Doyle, so much for your report, for taking our questions, and for bringing Nicole's report. We're sorry she's sick, and we hope she gets better. Everybody, at 3 o'clock in this room will be the FCCLV presentation on accessible pharmacy, and in Anchor will be easy chair yoga. 4 o'clock, CBS in this room. 7 o'clock, our banquet. Thank you, Director Doyle. Everybody, please give him a hand.